How much of our past trauma history should we tell a new person, someone we're thinking about dating? Do they need to know anything? Is there a risk to sharing these details? Welcome to this episode of Breaking Free from Narcissistic Abuse. I'm your host, Dr. Carrie Kerr-McAvoy. I have over 20 years of counseling experience as a mental health specialist, and I'm also a narcissistic abuse survivor. Today, we're going to talk about how much is too much to share, as well as how do we handle a narcissist turning our family against us, and how do actually narcissists view relationship transitions like engagement, marriage, and pregnancy. These are all the things we're going to cover in this replay of a TikTok Live. Thank you so much for being a listener. Please leave a review. It goes a long ways in helping this podcast. And be sure to subscribe so you're notified of upcoming episodes. And consider giving a donation, the cost of a cup of coffee. As a listener-supported podcast, your contributions are greatly appreciated. I've been giving some thought lately to healing after narcissistic abuse. What is it that I, where am I today? What is it that I need to get into a better place? One of the things I've discovered is that it's very hard to obtain closure. When the whole relationship from the get-go, right from when we met the person, wasn't based on anything authentic, wasn't based on what was real, it was actually just a fantasy, a deception, then that means that there isn't a whole lot about what happens that is quantifiable, can be verifiable. It's a lot of things that is made up. It's created in the mind of the person who did the abuse. So when we're done, when we're left and we're sitting with a pile of rubble of our life, we're also then set with this mess without an ability to come up with clear answers to make sense. And yet one of the things that our mind needs in order for us to obtain closure is to understand cause and effect. Our mind naturally looks for patterns, and it looks like a maze. You know, you sit in front of a piece of paper with a bunch of scribbling lines on it, and you will put your pen to it and pencil to it and look for an out as a game. We like to have things make sense. We believe that there is structure and rules that govern what happens to our lives. And yet with these relationships, there aren't anything that makes sense. Everything that we thought we knew, everything that happened, the things that we were perceived to be going on was simply a manifestation of someone else in order for them to manipulate and control us. I one time asked my narcissistic sociopathic ex-husband, as we were getting ready to break up, I asked him, there is what I perceived happened. And I actually described to him what I perceived went on in our lives. I described how I got up, the things that I did, the way I spent my day, and so on. And then I described what I thought he was doing, how his day went, who he saw, how he spent his time. And then I asked, how close does the reality of what happened that I just described match the reality of what really went on your end of things? And he shook his head and said, not at all. Not at all. Now, by this time, I wasn't surprised. I expected that. I had known that what we were in he was extremely deceptive. But how many of you are struggling with the same thing, struggling to find closure, struggling to break a trauma bond, struggling with even maybe making a decision whether to stay or go? Where are you in this process? I'd love to hear from you today. How do you talk to a new partner about past abuse? This is a tough one, and I have been in the dating pool a little bit, not recently, but a little while ago, and I kind of kept I'm aware of what's happening in the dating pool, and there's kind of a movement happening actually where maybe women are doing it too. I'm not aware women are doing it, but it doesn't mean women aren't doing it. It's because I'm not trying to date a woman. That's why I don't know. But there are groups of people who then see anybody who's had a past of trauma as if those people are toxic or uncomfortable victims, and therefore they don't match dating criteria. I think that, first of all, that's a ridiculous idea, because the reality is that I got to hear Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, the expert, one of the leading experts in trauma, speak. And he said that, according to his statistics, was that 80% of all Americans, that's in America, we're not talking about the rest of the world, you know, think of America as a pretty safe place. If it's this bad in America, it's got to be worse everywhere else. That 80% of us have had a class A trauma, was what he said, which I thought was really shocking. So that means pretty much everyone you're meeting has had a traumatic event. And interestingly enough, here's another way to look at it. Anybody who has this concern suggests that they've had a bad experience, right? And wasn't that traumatic? That you've now had to make a rule about who you're going to meet in the future? It sounds like a lot of unfinished business to me. So anyway, irregardless of that, here's another reason we need to be careful about what we say, is because narcissists, sociopaths, and psychopaths are looking for information in order to mirror us better. So when they hear that you have a past experience of abuse, then they already know that you have been primed before, targeted, and successfully controlled. That then to them says that you're a possible new target for them as well, that they can exploit you. It gives them a tool, gives them information that they can then weaponize and use against you, all bad stuff. How do we know when to say this to somebody and how to say this to somebody? I agree with you, Jenny. It's a tough situation. I would say, view the first part of getting to know someone as just getting to know someone. I like to rush things, so I'm talking to myself. This is something I really struggle with. I'm one of these people that want to quickly know if this is going to go anywhere or not. So I'm trying to assess, is this have potential? So I want to know, how serious are they? What do they vision in the future? Are they looking for the same thing as I? And I'm telling myself, wait on all of that. Just view the first stage as having fun, hanging out with someone and getting to know them. Leave the heavy stuff behind. Not that it can't come up naturally, but I wouldn't lead with it, and I wouldn't like try to bring it out as a way to vet somebody. Nor, here's another thing, your history is private information. You don't owe your history to anyone, ever, really. Now, granted, intimacy is built on vulnerability, so I would assume you meet someone that really has your back, truly sharing who they are with you, then you're going to truly share who you are. But when we're dating with someone, none of those rules have been established or even earned or proven. So I certainly would be very, very careful what I share about who I am and what I've gone through in my life. Now, here's the other problem. If any of you who are on TikTok or Instagram or anywhere else and have a social media presence, that means you're talking about your past. So what do you do about that? That's another tricky topic that makes it really tough. You may find for a while that you just have to pull on another persona and be someone else until you're safe enough to reveal who you really are, and you can share what you're doing and your platform with this person. Those are some ways to approach it. People have to earn the right to know who we are. They don't just get it because we meet them. That's a rule I'm learning. When you grow up in a dysfunctional home where there's a lot of manipulation and control, they tell their children that they're not allowed to have an inner world. That's a very common rule with very dysfunctional families. The reason is because it's a way for the parents to maintain control of toxic experiences that they personally can't overcome or deal with. So the way they control it is they control the child by saying, you're not allowed to have an inner world and you're not allowed to keep secrets. That way they can manage everything that's happening in the family. Be careful if that's what you've come out of and you're used to, and because it will make you more prone to say more than you need to. Hope that helps, and good luck with the dating. I've been thinking about when I want to try again, and if I'm ready to try again, I'm thinking about it. At least that's different than it was. I've taken the past year where I've just like not been interested. At least now I'm thinking about it. It's important we get past our trauma responses, and we like Sapphire Styling says, we spill all our tea all at once. That's kind of like that's a trigger. We get scared, and we get scared they're going to reject us. But they need to get to know you as who you are, and then you need to feel that they're worthy of knowing more about you. This is kind of a crude example. I view social relationships, all social relationships, this way, and certainly can apply to dating. View them like a skyscraper, okay? So when you come to a skyscraper, the lobby is open to the public. And that's where you share the least amount about yourself. Yes, it's what you put on, the face you put forward, the persona you develop, but what you think, your opinions about things, your likes and dislikes, your history, you don't put that in a lobby. That's private. Then the first few floors are where acquaintances sit or anyone new. Those are people that either they're just people you see in your life, but that's like the cashier or the neighbor down the road or maybe even someone new. That's when you're trying to like kind of figure out the boundaries with this person, what you can trust them with or not trust them with. And then you get to the middle floors, and that's the middle floors where you start to share your likes and dislikes and a little more about who you are. But you save the big stuff for the upper floors. And people have to earn their way up floors. They have to earn that right to know those things. So that's another way to view it, is to ask yourself, what floor is this person on? And am I giving information that really is earning or deserving of this level of intimacy? I had never felt more alone during the years that I'd spent in the abusive relationship. Shame and fear cut me off from the rest of the world and made it difficult to share what was going on. Are you going through something similar? If so, then you're going to want to read my book, Love You More, The Harrowing Tales of Lies, Sex Addiction, and Double Cross. It's a true story of what happened to me. You'll discover that you're not alone, and that you'll find out also what it took for me to finally escape. You can buy the book at all the major online stores or buy it directly from me and get a discount. For info on where to get your copy, please see the link in my bio. How would you deal with a narcissist husband's turning family against you? Oh, he's got the smear campaign going on. Yeah, you know, you can't control those things. There's a whole lot. Basically, let me give you kind of like, this is what I learned the hard way. And here, I want to even give you more perspective. You know, you'd think as a therapist, I would have known this stuff. We don't talk about this in psychology. This is not a lot of research out there. In fact, I've been doing continuing education. I just wrapped up listening to Lindsay Gibson on dealing with emotionally immature parents. Highly recommend Lindsay Gibson's work. She's really great. I'm trying to find her book right here in front of me. It's called Adult Children of Emotionally Immature Parents, How to Heal from Distant, Rejecting, and Self-Involved Parents. So those of you who are struggling with family members, this is amazing. I just finished a lecture with her. I sat with 6 hours listening to her talk about her theories, treatment options, how to work with patients. She's got a follow-up book to this. It's called Recovery something or other. I don't have it. I should get it. She's great. I can't say enough about her. Right now I've started a new one with Sandra Brown. How many of you recognize Sandra Brown's name? She's another big researcher. She is the one that she did a big study at Purdue University with 600 pathological love relationships. And she's doing a discussion of narcissists, psychopaths, and sociopaths, and what happens in relationships with them, and what's all the research around it. I'm so excited. I've just started it, so I'll be sharing what I learned with you guys. It's really amazing. But one of the things that I've learned the hard way about these relationships is that there's a lot about it that is not based in fact, and it's terribly unfair, and it's going to be very, very biased against you. Very. Don't look for equity. Don't look for reasonableness. And don't look for rationality. Not going to be there. These people psychologically, just to give you a perspective, when a psychologist assesses somebody who's on the far end with narcissistic traits, so they're pathologically narcissistic, they're not that far off of being delusional. They're not far off of being psychotic, guys. So we're talking very low functioning. We don't think about that. I mean, because they appear well functioning in a lot of spheres of their life. They may be holding a decent job. They may be making good money. They get a lot of respect. A lot of people like them. They may even be experts in their fields and in contributing to society as a whole. But when it comes to their sense of self and how they relate to others, it's extremely low functioning. Think of an emotional, like a relationally emotional toddler. That's what you're dealing with when you're dealing with these people. And is there any rationality with a three-year-old? There wasn't in my life. None of my three-year-olds were ever rational. So that's what we have to begin to kind of get our heads around. And once you get your heads around that and really kind of let it sink in, it helps a whole lot with how you handle what you do going forward. That really, really helped me a lot once I started realizing that. And here's the other thing. They are very amazingly charming and they seem normal. I'm about ready to put out, are any of you guys watching Starz Channel's show called Gaslit with Julia Roberts? It's about the Nixon administration, but it's about Martha Mitchell. Did you know there's a syndrome named the Martha Mitchell syndrome? Yeah, I'm going to put a TikTok out in the next couple days. What they did to her was what happens to all of us to some extent. So let me describe what happens. Narcissists, sociopaths, and psychopaths have what looks like a mask of, it's called mask of sanity. It appears like they're high functioning. They appear normal. And as a result, the world around them assumes they're following normal rules, that they're behaving like other normal people. They don't realize that this is a ruthless person who believes anything goes and that all fair and truly believes in all fair and love and war, and that they are actually abusing you. They don't know that. They can't fathom it because this person seems so reasonable. So as a result, that's what's happening. There's a war field being created around your husband. They believe him when they say the stuff that he says. He knows you well enough because he's very good at mind mapping to anticipate how you're going to respond. So he pre-sets it up so it's a trap. So you respond the way in which he anticipates you responding. You've triggered the trap and then you fulfilled whatever he predicted that you would do. Then he says, you know, she gets really upset about this and this and this. And then when they bring it up and then you react because you know it has a whole nother meaning and there's a backstory and that's a really bad moment and you react just the way he predicted. See, then he goes like, there you go. I told you, she's not rational. Martha Mitchell was actually one of the whistleblowers in the Nixon administration. She knew what was going on and she was telling people what was going on. And no one, they actually held her against her will hostage in California. And made her look crazy. That's what your ex or your partners are going to do. They're going to make you look crazy. So what do you do? Well, there's the sad part of all of this. You're not going to convince people who are not convincible. And if they're willing to buy into this, then you know something about this person. You know that they need to have his approval or her approval, whoever it is that's doing this to you. And that they're probably somebody that you really can't count on. It's awful because what often happens to many of us is we get on the other side of these relationships and we find out we really basically have almost no relationships left and we have to start over. That's a long answer to say you can't stop it, but here's some ways to think about it and some reasons why it's happening, and maybe that can help you process it better, make sense of it. But it's hard. That's why I started today talking about the importance of community and importance of finding people who understand what you're going through and can be behind you. And I'm really sorry this is happening. It's unfair. It's awful. It's really terrible. How do you deal with a covert narcissistic mom and sister? We use a lot of terminologies that we all assume we all know, and we often are describing different things. So I'm not exactly for sure what you're describing when you say covert. To me, a covert narcissist is someone who wants to be grandiose, wants to be the life of the party, the center of the attention, all the admiration, but has failed at it. And so what they do is they're accentuating their victimhood. They are the perpetual victim, and they're super passive aggressive, and they appear sweet and nice. That video, again, about that compliment that's not a compliment is a good example of a covert narcissist gaslighting, where they tie you up, they make it look like they're doing good things, and then they really backhand you bad about it. That's what I'm assuming when you use that. So how do you deal with it? Again, it comes back to how you're going to manage the contact with this person, whether or not you can go no contact if that's possible. Whether or not the family's health and the need for you in their life or your sense of moral obligation. I know people like, what? You don't owe it. No. Yeah, but you know what? We want to be civil people. So it depends on all of those factors. Maybe you can exit. Maybe you can't. But I would certainly really look at the ways that you could go limited to no contact if possible. Because there is no rational way to deal with them. I guess the way to think about it is think of your boundaries. Like when this comes up and they start to grill me on this or gaslight me on that or criticize me about that, I'm going to do X, Y, Z. These are the things I would say to myself. I wouldn't say that to them because it doesn't matter. They won't hear it. They'll just attack you again and put you in some other new emotional black hole corner. So why give them that leverage? Don't give them that leverage. But I would set up, when I have a visit, I would say, this is how long I'm going to be around this person. This is what I'm going to talk about. And if the conversation degrades into this direction, this is what I'm going to do. And then do that. Like if it starts to go south and gets nasty or it becomes passive aggressive, I'm going to say my polite goodbyes and exit. So it really is more about you learning to hold your boundaries, defining what they are, figuring out how you're going to manage that, and making sure you define boundaries that you can actually hold. That's so pivotal. Don't say something you actually don't have the wherewithal to do. And by the way, no judgment on that. No judgment. It takes time to get good at boundaries, especially when you've been urged never to have any boundaries, or it's been taboo, or there's big consequences not to have boundaries. So it takes practice. It's a muscle that you have to grow, just like you do every other muscle. You know, if you're not ready, you're not ready, but you can get ready in other ways. So be kind to yourself on that if you struggle with that. It's all a process. It's all a process. We're learning. Information on pregnancy and narcissism. This is a great question. You'll have to say more about it. I'm kind of making some conclusions and I may miss the angle you're asking for. So if you would come back and say more, I will watch for that. But one common thing that happens is that narcissists like to use big events, big commitments as a way to further entrap us. And pregnancy is a big one because then they know forever we will be in their lives because of the custody issues with children. And they tend to get really excited about those things. They love those things. Mine was very big into transitions. You know, when we got going steady, he, you know, labeled it as going steady, or when we got engaged, it was a big moment. Or when we got married, it was, you know, because those things make you more, you're more stuck. They're more, they've entrapped you bigger into the relationship and making it harder for you to leave. So they're insulating themselves from the risk of you just walking out. Children really do that. Pregnancy really does that. So you may find them super thrilled that there's a pregnancy because of that, what the meaning of it for them. But you may be asking a different question, so I'm not quite for sure the angle that you're taking. So if I missed the point of it, please let me know. What do you do about it? There's really nothing you can do about it other than to be aware of it. Being aware of it then helps you to be aware of why this is a big moment. But remember, here's the thing, the mistake that I made, it's a mistake a lot of us make, is that just because it's significant and we think we understand the significance to them because of the significance to us, we assume that what happens in our head is what's happening in theirs. It isn't. It isn't anywhere near the same. Don't make those assumptions. Their world is very, very different. I can hardly imagine what their world's like inside their head. For one, I already know that there's a part of their brain that has to do with mentalization of self, you know, self-reflection. That part of them is actually enlarged. They tend to have excessive preoccupation, focus on self inside their head. They're always like running everything past it from the perspective of what's this mean for them, and the fantasies about what it will do for them. And in a way that the rest of us, that part of our brain just isn't built like that. Oh, so you found out a week ago that you're pregnant. Now he's rude. He's not caring. And he's happy and nice, probably with other people. Yeah, so it's, now that you're telling me a bit more about this, it sounds like it sounds like it's shaking him. You know, that maybe he's feeling like you've done this to him and he's lost. I'm guessing now, okay? I'm just guessing. I don't know anything. And please don't take this as therapy. This is just me making some hypotheses, okay? But my guess would be that if this is, he's not reacting like a lot of them react, actually. It surprises me to hear this, but there's just some guesses of why he's reacting in a different way. It could be this is felt sprung on him, and now he feels out of control, and as a result, he's freaking out and thinking that maybe, and remember, they tend to run towards paranoia. I'm not saying they're paranoid, but they have a very warlike view of the world. They see people as competition, people against them, you're against them. He doesn't see you as a partner. You're not a partner in crime with him. He sees you as an opponent. Sad, but true for all of us. So it may be that he feels you've done this to him, and he's not for sure quite what more you're going to do to him and how this is going to hurt him. So he's being rude because he's anticipated this is a destructive thing, and he's getting antsy. It could also be that. Yeah, I agree with you, Mimi. It might be my theory that he sees this is a threat, but it also might be that he's now feels like you're like Mimi is saying, you're now on the line, girl. You're not going anywhere. You're having his baby. And so as a result of it, he's letting his mask slip as a result of it. That happens too, and that can happen really fast as well. So thank you for bringing that up, Mimi. You may be right. It may be another reason is that he's over it already and he's moved on. And Sarah, that's a great question. Why do they date us if they see us as opponents? Because everybody's an opponent. Nobody's not an opponent. So there would be no one to date. I mean, if the whole world's at war and it's all against you, everyone's against you. Yeah. And so what they do is they pick people they think is either very agreeable, very going to be easy to manage, or somebody that somehow is going to make life easier for them or bring something to, those are great assets, somebody they're going to cannibalize really well. They'll pick you for what you bring to the table or the way you make them feel when they're around you. That's another big one, is that they say, oh, you make me feel so good. And like, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Breaking Free from Narcissistic Abuse. Are you struggling to leave a narcissistically abusive relationship? Maybe you feel trapped, even paralyzed. I sure felt that way for a long time. Then you're going to want to be sure to get your tickets for a live webinar coming up this August 18th, 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm conducting a live interview with Dr. Kristen Milstead, and in the last 30 minutes, we're going to be taking your questions, the audience's questions. This is going to be an amazing evening. See the link in the show notes to get your tickets. And I will see you back on Monday. Bye.